This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, and we are live from the Upstage Cabaret in Greensboro. In the late 1960s, North Carolina had the largest and most active Ku Klux Klan organization in the country. And that was largely because of a charismatic man named George Franklin Dorsett. He was the Imperial Clud, or Chaplain, of the United Klans of America. Dorsett's fiery speeches and magnetism attracted more than 6,000 men in more than a dozen chapters in North Carolina. Dargan Frierson was an FBI agent in Greensboro and the agency's COINTELPRO program. He was part of that. And it was J. Edgar Hoover's plan to infiltrate and destroy any organization that Hoover himself deemed a threat to American security. And that would include the Klan. It would include the Black Panthers. It included the Southern Christian Leadership Conference as well. Dargan Frierson succeeded in disrupting the Klan in North Carolina. His success came when he recruited Dorsett as an informant. Dargan's son, Michael Frierson, is a filmmaker and a professor at UNC Greensboro. And he has created a film called FBI KKK that tells his father's story. Michael Frierson joins me on the program today. Michael, welcome to
you. Great. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. Tell us about your father, a little bit about where he grew up and how things were for him.
Yeah, my dad is from Central South Carolina, and he was the seventh generation of a family that owned a plantation in the central part of South Carolina called Cherryvale. And, you know, grew up in the Jim Crow South and lived through the Depression, became a first lieutenant in World War II, and sort of, you know, had one foot in the old South, you know, looking back to the gallant lost cause of the Confederacy, but, you know, forced by World War II to move out into the broader world and sort of step out of the old South into the changing world of the new South.
How did he get involved with the FBI?
He actually heard Melvin Purvis was one of the famous agents who worked on some of the classic gangster cases in the 30s and 40s. And he came through South Carolina and gave a speech somewhere, I think at University of South Carolina, where my dad was a student. And my dad got really interested in the FBI and saw, you know, Hoover was very, J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, was very good at public relations. So he had a lot of these kind of even comic book characters, radio shows that promoted the exploits of the FBI in the 30s.
So he's imagining, I guess, this kind of crime-fighting organization that gets the bad guys off the streets.
Absolutely. I mean, it's fidelity, bravery, and integrity. I mean, FBI stands for something, you know, in his mind, something very good in the world.
Then the FBI started this program called COINTELPRO, which was designed to disrupt, not just investigate, but to disrupt organizations like the Klan and others. When did that get started, and how did your father get involved?
Well, I mean, it really goes back to the 50s, and in the height of the Cold War, you know, Hoover was rabidly anti-communist and thought that there was an active communist conspiracy to take over the United States that embodied itself in the HUAC hearings in the 1950s. And so in terms of coming a part of the racial scene, a lot of it grew out of the fact that the violence in the Deep South, like the murder of Viola Liuzzo, the three civil rights workers who were killed in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and buried in that dam, and then the three young girls who were killed in the Birmingham bombing, you know, the violence the Klan was perpetrating in the Deep South was came to be seen as a threat, even by Southern conservative congressmen, as a threat to segregationism, as a threat to conservatism. And so they thought that, you know, the Klan has to be investigated. And on one aspect, they reopened HUAC hearings against the Ku Klux Klan. And then on the other, Robert Kennedy basically just forced Hoover's hand and said, you've got to start investigating the Klan as a subversive organization.
So as you suggested in your first answer, and as you portray in your film, your father, in terms of social ideology, really wasn't too far away from much of what the Klan said, apart from the violence.
Right. I mean, my dad grew up in the Jim Crow South, so his real transformation came going to the West Coast. He had he always says, I had a great World War II, because he lived in Taft, California. He was teaching, he was a flight instructor. He met a beautiful woman from Bellingham, Washington, and married her. She was an Irish Catholic. So for him, going to the West Coast was an eye-opening kind of changing, life-changing experience. But, you know, deep at heart, it's hard to overcome your past. I mean, he was raised in a world where, you know, it's fine to have African-American kids and play with them around the house, but, you know, they weren't invited in for lunch. I mean, that's just a way of life.
Now his job is to infiltrate the Klan, to be part of this COINTELPRO program, and he meets Dorset. How did they connect?
You know, I'm sure my dad saw him at a number of rallies, and he wasn't an easy person to turn because he was hardcore Klansman. So my dad talked to him a couple different times before he was able to turn him. And basically, you know, because the Klan saw themselves as an anti-communist organization, you know, they saw the change in the integration as part of a communist plot, as something bigger. You know, the FBI just could go to them and say, hey, we're against the Communist Party too. My dad said, I hate Lyndon Johnson as much as you do. You know, but we got to keep the violence down. So he was able to win them over basically through friendship, you know, and also, you know, these guys were paid well. I mean, partially because they're risking their life. So I know for a fact that in some months, my dad paid Dorset $500 for information he provided. Doesn't sound like a lot of money, but I know for a fact at the time, Dorset's house payment was $90 a month. So if you think about getting five times your house payment, that's a pretty big inducement.
Well, I think that's one of the interesting things, and one of the things we have to remember about the Klan is that whosever interest they may have been serving, they were generally poor whites who were active in the Klan.
Yeah, and you know, and it's hard. I mean, we focus on the racist part of the Klan ideology, which is huge, and it's unavoidable. But they did see themselves as a patriotic American organization.
Why did your father think a guy, you know, because Dorset was a real leader. He's a guy who's actually recruited a lot of people into the Klan. Why did he think he'd be the one who would turn?
That's a good question. I mean, I at the end of the film, I never got up the guts to ask Dorset, hey, how can you be so invested in the Klan and rat out your friends? But there was a moment in the film where I took Jim Schlosser, who's a reporter here in Greensboro for many years. He took him down and said, hey, basically, you know, Mr. Frierson got you set up your own Klan group as a kind of divide and conquer idea. How did that come about? And Dorset, for the first time in the film, I noticed that he's like, I'm not sure he actually even caught on to that at the time. So I think there's a way in which my dad sort of manipulated Dorset. At the same time, you know, they were good buddies. I mean, my dad's an incredibly social, you know, he can talk to anyone. So I think he won him over just kind of as a friend, too.
Did the Klan, in a sense, did growing the Klan grow the FBI? Did they sort of grow hand in hand, the idea that these are two threats, or that the Klan's a threat, so the FBI has to become stronger?
Well, I mean, The thing about Dorset is basically they're running something that's essentially like a traveling medicine show. You know, they would rally all over Eastern North Carolina several nights a week, and they would burn huge crosses. I mean, if you're living out in the country, that seems as to be something kind of an attraction. You know, like a circus attraction or something. So they're able to get people to give money and grow these individual units. Well, it's certainly in my dad's interest to say we're growing the COINTELPRO program that's following the Klan. And so in all of these units, they would get many informants. At the end, you know, by the 68 or 69, there's many old jokes about, you know, at any Klan rally, there's like, or Klan meeting, there's, you know, four or five informants present, and they're all on the payroll. So,
well, did Dorset ever go to jail?
He was arrested at the sort of end of his life, or end of his Klan, fiery Klan period. He lived in the Glenwood neighborhood here over in Glenwood. They were, you know, kind of outsider, wild-ass guys. I mean, they drove motorcycles. There's a point at which Dorset had a rattlesnake in his backyard, and they had these kind of boxes that they kept caskets in, you know, it's kind of a threat to the general community. And so the city actually actively tried to shut down and evict him from his house as a public nuisance. And he got sort of out of control at that point, and they took a black effigy and took it around the Woodmere Park neighborhood and burned this effigy to sort of threaten the people in Woodmere Park who were integrating at the time. So he was arrested for disturbing the peace at that time. And, of course, for all of that time, he had hanging over his head, they had gone to the HUAC committee in 1965 and taken the Fifth. So they were placed under contempt of court. So that contempt of court charge from Congress hung over their heads for many, many years.
HUAC is the House Un-American Affairs Committee that was focused on communists, but also took on the Klan. Did he testify?
He pled the Fifth the entire time.
Pled the Fifth. Was he ever outed? Did anybody find out?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, by the early 70s, Klan membership had gone from 6,000 members down to 250. And Hoover died in 1972. And part of the process when Hoover died, his personal secretary went in and started burning his personal files, starting with Z. But they stopped that process by the time he was at the letter L, so they still had all of that material. This is right at the time that the Watergate hearings came out, and so the role of the FBI in becoming not just an intelligence gathering organization, but a counterintelligence organization that's basically trying to actively disrupt people who basically have First Amendment rights to say whatever they want, you know, that issue becomes under investigation by Congress. The Church Committee did extensive, investigations of what exactly was the FBI doing as a national security agency. They were investigating, the Indian rights movement, the women's rights movement. I mean, it was huge. It was a very large program. So that was really the beginning of, Congress limiting the amount at which the FBI could pursue people who were basically exercising their First Amendment rights.
Yeah, and that became the problem, investigating and then disrupting whole organizations as though they were criminal in and of themselves, and of course
sure.
They weren't, and also working actively with local police, resulting in murders of Black Panthers in both Oakland and
sure.
in Chicago, police murders of,
sure.
of Black Panthers. So this kind of thing, this is how it gets out of control, this is why it was investigated. Did your father have a sense? I mean, when you're on the ground as an agent, just kind of doing your job, did he have a sense that this was somehow running afoul of the Constitution?
I think he was aware of that. He has told me many times he never did any black bag jobs where they broke into people's houses or illegally monitored people's phones or sent letters to people's employers pointing out that this person is a Ku Klux Klan member. He didn't really want to get involved in that, and he didn't have to because Dorsett was providing him really good information. So, yeah, and just to return to your previous question, I guess I didn't answer that. Yes, Dorsett ultimately was outed by the Church Committee in, I guess it would be 73 or 74. And, my dad had told Dorsett, Dorsett, your name will never be made public. And there it was all over the newspapers in Greensboro. And it was pretty devastating for my dad's opinion of the FBI, that's for sure.
What about your dad's personal journey in terms of his understanding and ideas about race?
Well, I mean, again, he starts out in the 20s, living in the Jim Crow South, kind of one foot in the old South, one foot in the new. The World War II thing really opened his eyes because he did move out of the South. He flew airplanes and lived in California. He married a very liberal woman from Bellingham, Washington, and brought her back to the South in, post-World War II. So I think that was part of a process that started to open his eyes. The other thing is, right down the road here at the Woolworths, the thing about the civil rights movement, it made inequality concrete right in front of your eyes. I can buy something over here, but I can't sit at this chair. I mean, that was an incredibly effective way to show people the stupidity of it, the inequality of it. So, he was out there every night, and he saw how this was going down. And, I mean, he's a basically good person, so it really changed him over the course of that period.
Why did you make the film?
Well, somebody came to me and asked me if they could make the film, and I thought, wait a minute, I'm a filmmaker. Why don't I make this film? I did have an in with Dorsett because I knew Dorsett. He had painted my house. He's a house painter, and he'd painted my house before. He's an accessible guy. And I really just want to get the story down before my dad passed. He's 90. He's still alive.
Was it difficult? Was it a hard film for you to make?
It is hard because you sit there. I mean, what I wanted to do was come into it with sort of an open mind about it. I know that sounds ridiculous, but I've often thought, and this is a common idea, you know, you can immediately think Nazis are monsters, right? And just say, that's the end of it. But actually, if you approach something with sort of an open, sympathetic idea, you know, it turns out Nazis actually are just human beings. You know, that's the basis. How did they end up so weird? So you have to come in with it with a little bit more open mind. So that was my idea, just to be sort of I don't want to say sympathetic, but open to just to listen to what these folks had to say. So it took me a while to get Dorset to talk about the issue. And he seems almost reluctant in 1990, well, let's see, I guess it would be 2000 to say. I sat him down and finally he said, I preached on the radio and I preached against integration. I gave Klan sermons. And I said, well, what would be in a Klan sermon? He said, basically I said that, you know, black people are another species. They're subhuman. And therefore interracial marriage, you know, it's like bestiality. And just to sit there and hear that, it's mind-blowing. You know, that somebody can still hold that idea through their whole life.
Did he ever suffer any repercussions once he was outed?
No, he didn't. He bought a bulletproof vest and wore it quite a bit, but he never suffered anything directly.
And in terms of the difficulty for you in putting this together, you leave a clip in the film, a moment where you catch your father who's about to slip, and
right.
he's about to use the N-word,
right.
and it's later in his life, and you left it in. Why?
Well, I mean, part of it is I took him back to South Carolina. There's a Church of the Holy Cross right there. It's a gorgeous church that, in fact, his great-great-great-grandfather had helped build with the help of slaves. But I took him back to that church, and he lapses right into that South Carolina way. I hope I'm not offending people here from South Carolina, but it's a certain kind of mindset in that particular milieu that he grew up. And he starts to say, house in. And, you know, I figured, you know, that is part of his personality. I mean, people have to realize that for that generation, it's something you have to overcome. You can't just assume that it doesn't exist. What's interesting is about exact that time this is going on, here's Obama going through the same thing about the race issue with his mom, who is white, and you know, Obama says, my mom occasionally utters racial epithets that make me cringe. Well, guess what? That happens in a lot of generations. I mean, one of the things I've discovered from, you know, making the film is it's kind of embarrassing to put your family up there and sort of go through this racist past, but you'd be amazed how many people come up to you and say, you know, I had to overcome the same thing. You know, it's a different generation that we've tried to move beyond every time. So,
has your father seen it?
Yes.
What does he think?
He loves it.
Okay. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Sure.
That was great.
Sure.
Michael Frierson is an associate professor and the director of graduate studies at the Department of Media Studies at UNCG. For information about the documentary, you can go online and search fbi-kkk.com. We're live from the Triad Stage at Greensboro. Taking us out of this segment and into our next is the Estanza Project.